Good morning, everyone, and we seem to have a good crowd, warm, smiling this morning. It's encouraging. It's encouraging to we who have volunteered to take the platform this morning and present to you a heritage that belongs to each one of us. And that is the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. But before we give that out, we're going to read the program for January, February, March, the year 2013. This morning, January the 6th, the topic will be the basics of meditation. The overall topic for the month of January is the path of spiritual evolution. And we would stop just right there to ask you to pay attention to the words and not the speakers, because it's the language and the words that we pass along. Everyone, if you haven't gotten one yet, should have a copy of this little yellow pamphlet, because it explains everything that we're doing here in these rooms. And as you see this morning at 11 o'clock promptly, we started the Sunday class. It's a discussion, and it'll last from 11 till noon. Doors opened at 10:30. On Wednesday night, we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. This class begins promptly at 7:45 and is over at 9. However, the door is open at 5:30, and for 2 hours, you have an opportunity to visit our library in the front of the building. It's filled with the straight line theosophical literature plus other supporting pamphlets which help you to delve into the teachings. Because as we stated, the words mean nothing unless we study them, get a hold of them, roll them over in our minds, and get deeper into the meaning of United Lodge of Theosophists. All the work, of course, is supported by voluntary contributions, not only in time and work, but also in whatever contribution of money you wish to make. There's a little box on the top of the bookcase on your left-hand side as you run come in. However, you can also give whatever you wish to the volunteer at the desk in the middle of the room, at a table filled with theosophical literature that you may purchase at a very reasonable price. And of course, in these days, at the bottom of the pamphlet, you'll see a notice telling you that on www.ultphiladelphia.org, you can pick up more information. Incidentally, in March, which is a little way from here, there will be a special meeting on a special Sunday honoring William Q. Judge. And we'll know more about him, because occasionally we see literature and we see a bust in the library. That's William Q. Judge. Who is William Q. Judge? Who is Robert Crosby? Who is H.P. Blavatsky? Now, we promised you to read the United Lodge of Theosophists Declaration, and we originally said, please, please, not the speaker, or even the deliberate, perhaps, but get a hold on these words. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. Without professing attachment to any theosophical organization, It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim and purpose and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race or creed or sex, condition or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. As is the custom, before the talk begins, a reading is given. And this reading, this morning, comes from the Bhagavad Gita. Wonderful little book, about 1/10 the size of the secret doctrine Isis unveiled. It's taken from the 3rd chapter, Devotion Through the Right Performance of Action. Krishna. It hath before been declared by me, O sinless one, that in this world there are two modes of devotion, that of those who follow the Sankhya or speculative science, which is the exercise of reason and contemplation, and that of the followers of the yoga school, which is devotion in the performance of action. A man enjoyeth not freedom from action from the non-commencement of that which he hath to do, nor doth he obtain happiness from a total abandonment of action. No one ever resteth a moment inactive. Every man is involuntarily urged to act by the qualities which spring from nature. He who remains inert, restraining the senses and organs, yet pondering with his heart upon objects of sense, is called a false pietist, a bewildered soul. But he who, having subdued all his passions, performeth with his active faculties all the duties of life, unconcerned as to their result, is to be esteemed. Do thou perform the proper action. Action is superior to inaction. The journey of thy mortal frame cannot be accomplished by inaction. All actions performed other than as sacrifice unto God make the actor bound by action. Abandon then, O son of Kunti, all selfish motives, and inaction perform thy duty for him alone. Even as the flame is surrounded by smoke and a mirror by rust, and as the womb envelops the fetus, so is the universe surrounded by this passion. By this, the constant enemy of the wise man, formed from desire, which rages like fire and is never to be appeased, is discriminated knowledge surrounded. Its empire is over the senses and organs, the thinking principle, and the discriminating faculty also. By means of these, it cloudeth discrimination and deludeth the Lord of the body. Therefore, O best of the descendants of Bharata, at every very outset, restraining thy senses, thou shouldst conquer this sin, which is the destroyer of knowledge and of spiritual discernment. The senses and organs are esteemed great, but the thinking self is greater than they. The discriminating principle is greater than the thinking self, and that which is greater than the discriminating principle is he. Thus, knowing what is greater than the discriminating principle and strengthening the lower by the higher self, do thou of mighty arms slay this foe which is formed from desire and is difficult to seize. Let us listen further.
So our topic for today, the basics of meditation, is a topic which we have to say, we'll just start this off with, you know, it's much, much easier to meditate than it is to explain what meditation is, or to explain to someone how to do it. Now, we come to this meeting, we have to say, we're not here to give out a formula of this is the way to do it, because really, depending on the individual, we all come to meditation with different strengths or different weaknesses, different capacities, different limitations, and so really, to learn to effectively meditate, or to more effectively meditate than we have been, simply, it requires effort and trial and practice and learning what works and what doesn't. And there's a certain intuition as though we know we're on the track now. This is something new, or this is something deeper. Well, okay, so what is meditation? Well, you know, the word meditation can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. To some, it means outright prayer. To some, it means find a place of solitude, and it doesn't have to be in an empty room. We could be on a train amongst the commotion, but it's a long train ride, so we find our own special place to look within and spend the time in a useful way. Some view meditation as a collectivity of people getting together for a certain purpose. But theosophy has different ideas about that, and to get into it, first of all, we would like to say what meditation is not, or a couple of warnings about meditation that some people may or may not appreciate. And the first is along the lines of mantras. A mantra is a word or a phrase that people will say over and over to get into what they may think is a meditative state. And the challenge there, or the problem with that, is that too often a mantra really can be self-hypnotizing. And self-hypnosis is putting oneself into a passive state in a trance, as opposed to a truly active state of control where the mind is fully aware and fully conscious. So we have to make a distinction in meditation. It is not a passive activity where we just kind of let things happen with our mind, but rather a very definite activity of the mind. So consider that idea and that warning that the philosophy gives about mantras. The second thing that seemed to be prevalent with some people regarding meditation is, of course, on the one hand, we need to enter it with a tranquil, in a tranquil state of mind and body. But to some, that means clear out your mind. Don't think about anything. Have a blank slate. And the concern with that, theosophically speaking, is if you're not putting something in your mind and maintaining control of it, then is it in its passive state, is it not open to the influence of things external to us? And so the idea that, you know, an adept has complete control of his full constitution, his mind, his body, his desires and everything, and control of the things around him, whereas a medium on the far other end of the scale turns control of her vehicle over to an outside, whatever it may be. The emphasis here is, you know, wherever we are, somewhere in the middle, maintain control, don't be passive when we go into these meditative states. So, how do we maintain control? To get an idea of that, it's very helpful. And we see that there's some new folks in the audience, so we're going to take a minute and go into the sevenfold nature of man. It's helpful to go into this idea of meditation, knowing that we're not just this physical body. So what is this sevenfold nature of man? St. Paul taught in the Bible that, and the Christian scheme is, well, man is spirit, mind, and body. And theosophically speaking, the idea is we'll take that but expand it, because really it's a sevenfold, not just three. And that sevenfold nature we can break down into very two simple components. One is the temporary, here and now in this life, which is comprised of the physical body, the astral body, our vital force or our vital body, and our body of desires. These we can look at as vehicles which we use during this life. And after we pass, the constitution of those four vehicles dissipate into nature and to the planes where they belong until we return and are reincarnated. Now, that's the one, the temporary. Then there's the permanent aspect of the human nature. And we refer to that as the ego. Sometimes you might hear the word triad, but that is the real person, the real immortal thinker. And the three, you know, we refer to it as a threefold entity, as mind, wisdom, and spirit, okay? So we have an immortal thinker entering into this animal, lower nature, fourfold nature, and it's an instrument, this lower nature, that needs to be controlled if it's going to be used for the highest purpose we can think of. Now, when we incarnate, it's our mind, that it's the mind aspect of our immortal nature that actually incarnates and, as it were, gains control over the physical. The challenge there throughout life and when we meditate is our mind, while we're incarnated, is dual. And we use the phrase higher mind and lower mind. It's not that there are two different minds, but that there's two different aspects of it. Some people say there's two different uses of it. We use it for a higher purpose or a lower purpose. So however you want to think about that. But the lower mind is grounded in stuff of the body and desires and sees out into the world. And if we ground ourselves in that as this is our reality, then we're missing out, A, on some of the higher spiritual universal principles, and we're missing out on the fact that we are the controller of this body. We're not the body. We're not our circumstances. We're observing the circumstances, and we control the body. There are plenty of folks who don't see it in that perspective, but theosophically speaking, if we can maintain through the day, every day, this view of I'm the observer of what's happening, and I thoughtfully, mindfully speak, think, and act in ways because I have a clue of how the law works and I want to work with the law, That's the human being. Animals can't do that. And the distinction is we are mind beings. So when we talk about meditation then, we have to enter it in a tranquil state, and first and foremost, therefore, the best time to meditate is either in the morning, as soon as we get up, before breakfast, before anything else, or at the end of the day. If neither are possible, then of course whatever time of day we can set for ourselves is good to do, but we should make the point to make it the same time every day, if at all possible. That's to be stressed. It should be done the same time every day. So when we enter this, make the attempt to go into meditation, there are three things to consider when we meditate. And the first is, often with the word meditation, we hear the word concentration. And concentration, what do we concentrate on, or how do we direct our concentration? What is concentration? If we view the mind as a set of faculties, or if we view that the mind has faculties through which it operates, then those faculties, we're told, are what? Thought. What else can the mind do? Imagination, will, feeling, and memory. Thought, will, imagination, feeling, and memory. These are the five powers of the mind. And so when we talk about concentration, we're saying pull all of these together and use them toward the end of whatever it is during our meditative time that we're trying to do. So what are we doing with them? The best idea is to pick a single idea to focus on, because it's a practice of the mind, or we use the mind. And if we choose an idea to focus on, which can be, lofty and almost incomprehensible, so we want to use something that represents the highest idea. So some people, one person may choose, visualizing beauty in their world, but to just abstractly do that, I mean, that's tough, just the word beauty. However, if you visualize the flower and recognize that the flower is an expression of beauty, flower is not necessarily beauty itself, but it's an expression of beauty, then then we can recognize that, hold that in our minds, and apply it. What high philosophical idea applies in this town? And it's a 20-minute exercise. And one could be, the theosophical fundamental proposition of evolution. If we simply watch, if we observe the flower, opening through the day as the sun comes up, and corresponds that to the evolution of everything universally, then that is a time of practice, of focus and concentration, that will lead to a next step, subjective step to the individual. But the problem comes in when, sometimes it seems, as much as we try to do it, we get distracted and we end up thinking about this or all these different things that are going on, even though we are in control and we're sitting there. Well, that lower mind, it's the animal within you. And it's not who you are. But realize, remember, the duality of mind. We have to take the authority over it, and we have to take control over it. And don't get discouraged. It goes on all the time. You have to bring it back to what we're focusing on. This practice of meditation, if we do it consistently and bring it back, I mean, what's the nature of mind, the nature of the lower mind, is to just think about things that matter, things that don't matter, things that are pleasant to think about. But the higher mind is discernment. The Pyrine has the capacity to discern the value of the ideas that we're holding, and it has to take control and has to take authority over the lower. We're talking as though they were two distinct things, but that's just how it's coming out. You get it. It's really one mind, but two aspects. The higher mind has to take control of the lower and guide it back, And really, it works over time if we're steady. Just like training a dog. Early on, it's hard to get it to sit, but eventually, getting it to sit is second nature, and the more you train it to do things, the more it learns and is responsive to. And so it's a matter of, but with that dog, you have to do it at the same time every day, you have to be consistent with it, and there are certain conditions that you have to create so that it's not distracted. Now, one practice that is very helpful is actually a practice that was taught by Pythagoras to his students, and this is called retrospection. And in particular, at the end of the day, if we take a few minutes to settle ourselves and sit quietly and review what went on during that day. Now, we don't do that to judge ourselves. I should have done this when I did this, and I was wrong. But no, it's an opportunity simply to look at cause and effect. So we don't start, when we practice this meditative retrospection, we don't start in the morning looking at what happened. We start with what happened by the end of the day and go backwards through the day. Why is that? Because then we go from effect to cause, to effect to cause, to effect to cause. And that helps us recognize what's going on in our life on a daily basis under law, all the karma, the cause and effect, and learn from it. Don't judge it. But the effect of this, if we do it routinely, is that through the day, we come to be very much more in the moment. And we find ourselves making decisions mindfully, thoughtfully, because we have a deeper, more respectful attitude toward the law, rather than our stuff doing what we want, what the lower mind wants. If we realize everything is karma, everything is cause and effect, and we've routinely been going through our life on a daily basis, the tendency will become to more thoughtfully, mindfully live our lives. And so that's one thing to consider, very helpful retrospection during the... Now, we're sure that folks have come here with lots of ideas, and, you know, we've only scratched a little bit of the surface of what meditation is and can be, but, you know, we're going to open the floor for discussion and contributions and questions of all sorts so we can kind of mold it together a little bit. Yes?
Seems to be one area. Been a pitfall for me in that I tried to combine them all into one for a long time, thinking that I was being unsuccessful at any of them. For me, meditation now means very simply becoming the observer and choicelessly aware of anything that happens, and that just creates the meditative state. And that seems to be contradictory to the other things that have been described, such as like holding your concentration on something. To me, that seems like it's actually contracting your mind and awareness into a box, whereas the idea of meditation, to me, is to expand your awareness behind you so that it includes everything around you. And it's not a passive state, it's still an active state. You are choicelessly sensing and feeling and everything around you.
Certainly it does. And as was said, you know, we could have 12 words for the word meditation because they all have different nuances. And in this language, we just have the one. We agree. In that meditative state, we become more aware of our surroundings and we become more aware of our heartbeat. I mean, your heartbeat can get loud, actually, if that's what we focus on. And we would agree with everything that was said. The emphasis being that it's an active awareness. We think the words were, you know, it's a choiceless observation. We'd agree. Observing the law, observing what comes, what's been going on with us, what's in the moment, but always in control. And if we we have to be careful not just to let the lower mind decide to think about whatever it wants to think about. That's not the purpose of meditation and concentration. So, we appreciate the contribution. And there's hands waving. Yes, in the black.
We had an analogy in mind a minute ago, and it fits well with what was just said. We would disagree, however, with the word choicelessly, because, and our analogy is, we are driving a car, and we now have laws which tell us the distraction of a cell phone, the distraction of texting, the distraction of music that's way too loud, are now against the law, because we cannot focus our attention on the task at hand, which is making sure we get from point A to point B without hurting ourselves or anyone else. But that is not choiceless. So what was said earlier was an awareness, an open awareness of every point of the day. That's a choice to do that. Otherwise, we're distracted and we're flying from one thing to the other, as was described earlier. So we wanted to give credit to that process as being a choice.
We understand what you're saying, and so where the words choiceless was chosen, those words were chosen, we see the idea, and perhaps another word to use would be non-judgmentally recognizing what's going on. Perhaps that would be the fit. Yes, in the white in the back.
Then perhaps what happens is when that monkey mind, that lower mind aspect takes off, and there's a tendency for the lower mind to fly to another subject matter, then the meditative pondering would become actively, I didn't make that choice, but I see where that thought went. What triggered that? How can I bring that thought back? So that metacognition, that process of observing where it went, noting where it went, and what kind of effort does it take to come back to oneness and focus. Maybe that's key to this choicelessness, if you will.
Thank you. And the active word there being the metacognition. So the difference being, you know, are we conscious? Of course we're conscious. But dogs are conscious too. And the difference between us and the dogs is not only are we conscious of our surroundings, we're self-conscious. Like, if the dog is hungry, he knows he's hungry, he's going to eat. But we know that the body's hungry, but that doesn't mean we're going to eat because we're making the effort to do something else, like lose weight. So we're self-conscious. Well, that same idea of self-conscious, I know that my body is hungry, but we're not going there. That is, so to speak, the fullness of that is in meditation. And when that mind starts doing that, bring it back. Be patient with it. We need to be patient with ourselves. So why does the lower mind always fly off like this? Our understanding is just the act of getting into that frame of mind triggers something in our same processes where these memories come flying in. And we have to screen it, and we're responsible for that. But the way to gain control over that, it's not a quick fix. It's actually living the philosophic life. The more that we gain control of our personal desires, and the more that we discern what's important in life and what's not important in life, and minimize the desires, the more control we have over our lower mind, because it's not being assaulted with this array of worthless, so to speak, desires that are constantly popping up all the way, you know, from whenever they may have been in our memory. So, yes, there's been a blue. Yes.
You speak about recognizing the law or becoming in tune with the law. There's been a lot of writing given about the structure of the higher planes, the nature of the higher existences and whatnot. Could you elaborate on some of these writings on the actual law? Or give an example of several of these laws, because I need to understand what the goal, once I reach that state of harmony, I need to understand what it is that I want to focus on at that point.
Sure. So when we talk about recognizing the law, the important thing is not to, like, in retrospection, we could go back through our day virtually every day and just criticize ourselves from start to finish and could have done this, could have done that. But it's not to judge ourselves, it's not to diminish ourselves. Rather, it's so that we can recognize how supreme the law is and come to honor it and learn, therefore, to work with it consciously every day, moment to moment. And so the question is, there are realms and spheres that are operating, causal spheres. Right, it's out there. And at this stage, you know, certainly we're not going to pretend to know that kind of stuff. But what we've read is that, yes, we affect so much more around us than we give ourselves credit for, because just like our parents told us when we were 4 years old, you are so much more than you think you are and your potential. It's true. So there's a lot of things that we do, that we cause, that we affect, that we have no idea of, which is why motive, ethic, a sense of morality, compassion, universal brotherhood in action, to the extent that I can see how I'm affecting the world around me, that, I mean, that, what more can we do? And we have to trust in the law that all the ripples of effect on whatever planes there may be. So to get to the highest that we can at this stage, we're told that in meditation, it can be very helpful to have a picture, an image of an individual, perhaps if an individual was raised in this, that, or the other religion, if there's a particular teacher, spiritual teacher, who is recognized as the penultimate human being, then have an image of him on the little table in front of you or her, always recognizing that this is a representation of one who has fulfilled the law. But that person is not the law, and we're not talking about worshiping other people, but recognizing that, you know, just holding this as the representation of the law can be very helpful. But to try to make the personal effort to get into those kinds of spheres, a lot of metaphysics there, we couldn't speak to it. Yes?
In meditation, perhaps it shows us something the earlier speaker spoke about, was that we, like in our dreams, we don't know where the things that come into our mind actually come from all the time. Oftentimes we do. Oftentimes we don't. Sometimes they're so crazy. If we focus in on trying to fight these things in a meditative state as they come in, we're going to defeat the whole purpose of being able to just be there with what is going on, with that choiceless awareness. When it's there, we will make a choice as to what we want to do with it. We will make a choice either to fight it, or make the choice to bring ourselves back to the purpose of why we're there. But as long as we are going to fight this thing and say it shouldn't be there, we'll drive ourselves crazy. So the idea possibly is whatever we're focusing in on, whether it be a higher idea or something that we agree upon that's useful or beneficial or good in our life, and to keep our mind focused on that. When the mind goes off, yes, we don't have to understand why our mind went off, but we have to understand that we can bring it back.
That we can bring
it calmly back. And what happens after a while, and every person will find this on their own, depending upon their karma, nature, and so on, is that we will get better at bringing the mind back, taming the monkey mind, as we say, bringing the mind, like the horse, so to speak,
thank
run
you.
Away. You bring the horse back, you mm-hmm. say, no, stay here, and it will stay.
And we think the salient point, we think the salient point with this contribution is don't fight what you don't want, but focus, bring focus on the object of the meditation. Otherwise, if you're fighting this, you're focusing on it, right? It's kind of like overcoming a vice. You know, focus on health, activity, and cardio, not on how big my thighs are. You know, because you focus on that, that's what you're focused on. We get where we're coming from. Yes.
After listening for a while to the declaration offered in these rooms, over and over again, we discovered that, now let me apply these ideas to myself in my daily life. What does it mean, contemplation, concentration, and meditation? Well, I discovered I couldn't be sitting in this room this morning if I hadn't done all three. So therefore, it's a matter of how to behave, ethics, law. And by just simplifying these ideas, to see just what's common to the book, well, the reading tells me that we are more than what we see in the mirror, and that we do have the power already and use it every day. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting here respecting each other, honoring each other, and listening. So maybe we should not make it so difficult by complicating things. Maybe we should listen to what the Declaration says and contemplate what Theosophy is offering. Perhaps then we have something to go by in more serious situations.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Was it the lady in the pink?
It seems, I feel that the main purpose of meditation is to still our very, very busy minds. Our minds are always busy. And to come to that point of stillness, we can feel that unity that that we want to experience, the unity of all life. And one way that we have learned to do this is imagery, and the suggestion was imagine a blue sky and clouds are coming in. And as the clouds are coming in, each cloud represents one of those busy thoughts. And you let those clouds, those thoughts float by and away. Don't worry what they are, but simply let them go and focus on that clear blue sky, which is the stillness of the mind. Personally, I have found that imagery very helpful.
Thank you. And really, as a contribution, where we see that is, you know, if one does that, using this example, on a daily basis, isn't he centering himself? And isn't there, and when we're centered, we're in more control. If we can't we maintain more control of our world around us? Maybe not. Our thoughts about the world around us, of how we feel about the world around us, yes, if we rely on this sense of this higher sense of I and seeing the universals for the particulars, yes.
It was brought up about the sevenfold nature of man, and
sure.
We consist of multiple bodies. Is there a common center to all these bodies, or do they each have a different center?
Is there a common center to all of the vehicles that we use? The common center would be the highest, the Atma. Atma is throughout everyone. So if we're going to use, is there a common center? Really, that's the common center. But Atma per se is present, but it is not per se active and in control. As mind beings, we are in control using the discernment and the discrimination, which is of Buddhi and the mind. And any other contributions? I know the gentleman in the black had his hand raised.
Well, it relates, it incorporates that to this kind of thought. So, but addressing this idea of the purpose of meditation in light of our umbrella topic,
mm-hmm.
path of spiritual evolution, control is good, peace of mind is good, centering is good, physical health is good, but the fact is that the mind becomes that, the nature of that ideal on which it is fixed. And the more we meditate on the highest ideal we can think of, whether it's that center or that self that pervades everything or whatever it may be, the more the mind evolves and expands spiritually with all the senses and faculties appropriate to that. So it is key to our spiritual evolution as mind beings. It's necessary.
So meditation is key to the spiritual evolution as mind beings. And then would we say probably really the center would be the mind more so than the Atma?
Well, we are mind beings, but we are working on these different planes through different vehicles or bodies, but it's always the same mind being or center of consciousness.
So it's always the same mind being or center of consciousness. So in respect to spiritual evolution, you know, how does meditation fit into this? Through meditation, we get more of a sense of who we are and what our capacities are, and our thoughts, actions, and words are different, and there's a different motive behind it. Rather than the lower, it's the higher. Now, spiritual evolution, when Theosophy talks about spiritual evolution of the mind being, it's actually not talking about the evolution of spirit. It's actually talking about the evolution, or our capacity to cause the evolution of the very vehicles that we incarnate into. So this vehicle is transmuted or degraded in this lifetime based on what? The efforts of mind. And meditation helps us to raise our motive and make greater effort in the right direction. But also, by the time this life is over, depending on the causes we've set up within ourselves, those causes don't just disappear. I mean, they're within our mind, waiting to be re-expressed. If we've lived a life of you know, if we've lived the philosophic high life, when we return, the mind, the character, will be all the stronger, in a better position to affect the world around us than it was even in the previous life. Thing is, though, that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get a healthier, stronger, smarter, happier body. That's not what it's all about. Because it could mean that the character and the mind has evolved to a level where now we're ready to take on old karma from previous lives that we've never been able to deal with before. And so, we could just get dumped on and have some really tough times in the next life. So it really all depends. I mean, that doesn't mean, so we look around at people with great challenges. That is not indicative of their spiritual evolution. We would need to be able to look into their heart, their mind, and the history of their karma as a soul to really understand what their situation is, which is why we're encouraged, you know, judge not that ye be judged. But meditation puts us in the, by meditating and therefore spiritually evolving, the efforts that we go through, which is sometimes it's called Raja Yoga, follows us into the future. It is a permanent incorporated essence of our character, the gains that are made through Raja Yoga and meditation. Yes, in the purple.
Is there, in regards to concentration, which was mentioned during the talk, is that a vehicle for meditation, or...
Could we hear the question again? Is what a vehicle?
Concentration.
Concentration, okay.
Is concentration almost... Can you, we look at that as being the vehicle for meditation, or we're just not sure where concentration fits into that whole picture?
Okay. Let's put that out to the audience. So how exactly... would we contrast or compare or distinguish between meditation? How does meditation and concentration fit into each other? Yes.
Well, concentration, if we can learn to put ourselves in a one-pointedness direction, it's part of the process of going into meditation, is to be able to do that when we want to, get that one-pointedness.
Thank you. So the concentration part of this, it would seem then, is definitely of the mind, probably more of the lower mind to get it focused. And remember, concentration is over time as we grow and as we develop in this life, concentration becomes more simple, we think, if by living the philosophic life, we start discriminating and minimizing the ancillary, worthless desires that often we're so focused on, and so in the meditative state with the higher mind is the observer, really looking down. It's almost like you're in a helicopter looking down at the map of your life rather than in the car driving around on the roads. And in the helicopter, looking down on the map, we were coming up with that concentration. Just a second. Yeah, we're killing ourselves. We got distracted. Never mind. Lady right next to you. And,
we think we have an idea of where you were going. Concentration by itself is not enough, because we can do that. We want something badly enough, we will concentrate on getting it.
Based on the desire.
Happen. So the map is the desire. The concentrated focus from above, or perhaps we start from below, but the concentrated focus is directed by our desire. One direction of desire makes it meditative, the other makes it lower and terrestrial and physical and so forth.
Thank you, and the idea came back. It's along that line. Once we minimize our desires and gain control of them, concentration has an effect in our brain and our lower, in the physical brain and the lower mind, to direct, like, all the cells and the fibers of the brain in one direction. The idea in the Ocean of Theosophy is, follow the dictates of the soul to make one's mind porous, and one should follow the dictates of the soul. And really, that's not something that eventually in some future lifetime, one day I'll have a brain that does that. No, you can do that now and start, and there will be results that we can see within ourselves. And there's been a hand here. Yes.
Yes, I rely on Lotus Journey. That tells me that you're on the journey without distance to a goal that has never changed. and also that life is largely about intention and attention. Thanks.
Thank you. Life is largely about intention and attention. And the other one was, we are all on a path.
We are on a journey without distance, to a goal that has never changed,
which is the search for truth.
I would imagine.
Thank you. Yes.
There's an interesting idea out there that our task at hand now in human evolution is to go beyond the mind. And it's intriguing to me because, you know, we've gone beyond the body, digestion happens, everything happens. And so now our task is to go beyond the mind. And, you know, the idea is that most of what we do and think is very mechanical. And I think that there's this false idea that we think we're really doing something, whereas in reality it's all just mechanical, and everything that we do is based on past experience and, you know, an idea of what we want to happen in the future. So for me, meditation is a practice of going beyond that false little mind to access the universal will, and then to allow that to unfold with me, through me. So I don't know, it's a stark contrast to what's being said in this room, but yet, I think that our concentration, our will, I think we're just fighting against something that will never work. All we have to do is just to allow life to happen through us, and that's what meditation is all about.
Thank you for the contribution, and the idea of getting beyond the mind, that's fully in line with theosophical teachings, and in its highest sense, you know, right now, at this period of evolution, that the human race is in, our mind is partially incarnated, which is why we talk about the higher and lower use of mind. In one sense, it's more incarnated; in another sense, it's not. But as time goes on, as we spiritually evolve and the vehicles that we use transmute in ways that have greater capacities to more fully serve as a full vehicle of mind, then we will fully operate fully from mind, which is, you know, on the one hand, grounded in desire right now, but on the other hand, also directed, as it were, to buddhi, toward wisdom and universal principles. And this bit about getting beyond the mind, there are those who do. And the practice of meditation and Raja Yoga, which actually 2 weeks from now there'll be a talk on Raja Yoga, that's all about making the effort to self-evolve, to cause that to happen. And there are those, and Theosophy has a lot in the literature on this, who evolve at a much quicker rate than the rest of humanity. And these are the sages among us. These are the great teachers. These are the adepts. It is said, so while we are all in the fourth round of evolution, we're not limited to this level unless we accept the conditions. If we recognize, I am the observer, I am not the conditions, I can internally set the conditions within me to evolve beyond, if the object is to be of service, then we might find ourselves in a position as Plato was, who was evolved to the level of the fifth rounder, or as the Buddha and Sankaracharya were, who were said to be evolved to the level of a sixth rounder. Sixth rounder being fully seated in buddhi. Now, once in a while, we get these epiphanies in a flash. It's not like we don't know or ever experience buddhi in its essence when we feel this flash, this sense of unity, whether it's in nature, we might get it from art or music, but it's almost, it's a foreshadow for what the human race will be in time, but it doesn't get there by living a passive, ignorant life. We are responsible to make that happen. If we don't make that happen, it's not going to happen. That's the idea. So we have time for one more question.
What? Could you shed some insight into the difference between the two terms, one being nihilism and one being non-dualism, and how are they different, or are they one and the same?
We have no idea. Nihilism versus non-dualism.
Okay.
the non-dualism is an aspect of Indian philosophy.
The Dwaita and the Adwaita, the Vaisishta Dwaita.
The idea that there's only one reality and everything else is illusion. Nihilism means that everything's an illusion, but therefore there's no purpose to life. Non-dualism say there is purpose to life, but it's based not on taking the changeable as the reality, but finding that reality through meditation and holding on to it and understanding it. So the difference is recognizing that illusion exists, but what are you going to do with it?
Thank you. So we've had a lot of contributions, a lot of great questions, and I think we all learned from each other today. Next Sunday, what's the topic for next Sunday? I guess I'm supposed to know. Is the care of body and soul, and then the following week is Hatha and Raja Yoga. We'll see you. Meeting's adjourned.
Thanks, Thomas. Thank you. I made an effort to listen because I usually get heavy distracted and just help the discussion. The activity just got so low.
Yeah.
Let me see. Did you turn it off?